Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about a variety of things. I've got some interesting stories in store for you. We're going to talk about blood type diets and some recent studies that shed light on whether blood type is a reasonable way of ascertaining what type of diet we should be put on. A blood type diet, of course, a very popular book by Dr. D'Adamo, and still a lot of people subscribing to blood type diets, and we're going to look at the scientific validity of that. Also, we're going to talk about licorice and its beneficial effects, especially on the gastrointestinal tract. But before we do that, I want to share with you a fascinating article that I came across in Science News. Science News is a great magazine. It boils down lots of important scientific stories. Many of them find their way into health talk broadcasts or intelligent medicine podcasts. So this one is about something that we talk about frequently here, the microbiome, gut microbes. And gut microbes, it turns out, are increasingly important in health. They may help people not just with gastrointestinal problems, with irritable bowel syndrome. There's new information that fecal transplantation, giving bacteria from the intestines of healthy animals to other animals, or even with humans, humans who have very severe gastrointestinal infections with things like C. difficile. They're no longer responsive to antibiotics. They're suffering from debilitating diarrhea. This actually can become life-threatening. And a fecal transplant, a transfer of microbes from a healthy donor's gut, can actually turn the entire disease around. We also have become aware that there are differences between the microbiome in people who are fat and people who are lean. So much so that, you know, when they're recruiting volunteers, you know, like they recruit volunteers to give blood, well, they also recruit volunteers to give feces for some of these protocols where they treat people with severe gut infections. By the way, this is something that's very, very restricted at this point. It's very much under scrutiny and regulation by the Food and Drug Administration and by hospitals, which have they've been granted experimental protocols to conduct this kind of research. It's definitely a research-based initiative. It's not something where, you know, these are commonly offered in clinics across the country for people with gastrointestinal problems. But it's a promising field. And so this article comes to us from Science News. It's an article by science reporter Megan Rosen. And the headline here is, "A Gut Infection Can Keep Mice Lean." She writes, "Skinniness could be contagious. Gut bacteria from thin people can invade the intestines of mice carrying microbes from obese people, and these invaders can keep mice from getting tubby." This is the problem, though. The benefits come with a catch. The invading microbes drop in and get to work only when mice eat healthy food, researchers report in the September 6th edition of Science. Science, a leading medical journal. Even fat-blocking bacteria can't fight a bad diet, says study leader Jeffrey Gordon, a microbiologist at Washington University in St. Louis, where some of this research is underway. What they're basing this on is that fat and thin people have different microbes in their intestines, and they've already demonstrated that normal weight mice, given microbes from obese mice, pack on extra fat. So they did an experiment, and they transplanted fecal microbes from obese and lean human twins into mice lacking gut bacteria of their own. Now, why do they do these twin experiments? Well, identical twins where one is fat and one is lean, that's a very interesting situation. There's actually some research on, lots of research that's underway about what is environment and what's genetics. I mean, to some extent, your weight is genetically determined, but also there are environmental influences. So looking at unusual circumstances where human twins, they separate and then they go off into different environments, and one is fat and one is thin, helps us understand the interplay between genetics and environments. So what they did is they took fecal microbes from obese and lean human twins under the theory that maybe there's something genetic about the microbiome, the microbes that you have, but maybe it's partially environmental. They gave these microbes to mice who were had sterile intestinal tracts. In other words, they had been, there's actually a special breed of mice where they have sterile intestinal tracts, and they're used for experimentation on the effects of bacteria on various aspects of the mouse's health. So within 2 weeks, what they found is that these mice who had, they didn't have any normal bacteria to begin with. They were sterile, and they got bacteria from either fat or lean human twins. The ones that received bacteria from obese people started to put on fat, and mice given bacteria from lean people stayed slim. So then they wanted to know if they could transfer these bacteria from one mouse to the other, if this is sort of contagious. So the team housed mice carrying microbes from lean people with still thin mice carrying microbes from obese people. And one of the things that you got to know about mice, this is a little unappetizing, is they eat poo. So they eat each other's poo. So you don't have to necessarily transfer the microbes from one mouse to the other. You just put them in the same cage, and they're gonna share their microbes. And what they found was that the microbes from lean people won. They actually overcame the microbes from the fat people. So it's a natural tendency, at least in this mouse experiment, for these better microbes, these lean microbes, to win out. They actually took over in the guts of the mice, even when the guts of the mice had been pre-inoculated with microbes from obese people. And the new lean microbes kept their new hosts from putting on weight. So then they repeated the experiment, but this time they fed both types of mice a high-fat, low-fiber diet based on American eating habits. In other words, a junk food diet, you know, kind of thing like, you know, McDonald's with fries. Although, you know, I don't want a lawsuit here. I'm not sure that they got the mouse food from McDonald's. And what they found was that on this diet, the lean people microbes seemed to protect mice from getting chubby. Mice with these bacteria gained less weight than did mice with obesity-related associated microbes. But when the researchers put the two types of mice together, the lean-promoting microbes were no longer able to colonize the guts of mice carrying the obesity-associated microbes. So without these healthy bacteria, the mice who had the fat microbes within them couldn't stave off excessive fat gain. So the conclusion is that obviously gut microbes count, and you can get them transferred from in this case other mice, or you know, they're transmissible probably through birth. But a bad diet can tip the scales, thwarting even helpful bacteria from getting into the gut and taking over. So, you know, what are they going to do? I mean, is this going to become a trend? Are they going to be able to, you know, will there be diet clinics that we set up where they actually feed fecal material to people to make them thin? Well, I doubt if that's going to happen. in the short term. First of all, this is a highly regulated field because sometimes you can get pretty nasty bugs from people in a, it's like Russian roulette. You know, you may get good bugs, you may get harmful bugs. You don't know what you're going to get because this is fecal material is a mixture of thousands and thousands and thousands of different bacterial species comprising literally trillions of bacteria. So what they're honing in on is one group of invading microbes called Bacteroidetes. And that's going to be the focus of a lot of research, you better believe, because right now the probiotics that are on the market are kind of crude. They don't focus on, you know, one or the other particular fat-promoting or lean-promoting microbe species. But the name of the game is to find and isolate the type of bacteria that could help protect against obesity. And they could be the next generation of probiotics, bacteria that people could consume to improve their health. But the take-home lesson is you will never be able to eat with impunity and just compensate with fecal transplants or probiotics because with a bad diet, these helpful bacteria simply won't take. So, you know, your microbiome has a lot of influence on this, but a bad diet can thwart even efforts to reintroduce healthy bacteria into your intestinal tract. Now, a little side box on this story. I didn't know this, but in 1958, way back in 1958, that's almost as old as I am, physicians used fecal transplants to treat patients with severely inflamed colons, presumably with conditions like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. But the idea has kind of lain dormant. That is, until now, and research is underway to explore the potential impact of fecal transplants in patients with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. They're already giving a certain type of parasitic worm, a whip roundworm, to people who have ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. That's being done, I wish the research originated in the United States, but they're, I believe, in the state of Iowa. But they are now doing this in Europe, and research is underway at my alma mater, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, to evaluate the efficacy of transferring live parasitic worms, or at least the eggs of parasitic worms, to humans to help regulate the immune system in the gastrointestinal tract. Maybe get the defenses of the gastrointestinal tract to focus more on repelling the parasitic invader and keeping it at bay than engaging in an autoimmune attack on self and damaging the intestinal lining. So this, we're going to keep our eye on the ball on this type of research because it's very, very promising. And no, you know, this is not a therapeutic modality that is yet available at the Hoffman Center. But should it prove useful and should it prove available and accessible, that is something to look forward to. Okay, next is the blood type diet. This is a diet that is extremely popular that was originated by the father of Peter D'Adamo, who is a naturopath based here in New York and Connecticut. And for many years, his father treated patients based on the concept that there was a certain type of diet that was right for their blood type. And the book Eat Right for Your Blood Type has been a big bestseller. Lots of people are adhering to the diet. Many people are achieving benefits by following this type of diet. There's also a belief that certain supplements are keyed into certain blood types, and this is a very, very popular notion. So let's take a look at some of the evidence for and against the blood type diet. Of interest is that there's a recent study that is in the American Heart Association journal, Circulation, that states that blood type increases heart disease risk. So this would seem evidence in support of the blood type diet, but let's take a look at what it really says. Blood type increases heart disease risk. people with blood types A, B, or AB have a greater risk for developing coronary heart disease when compared to those with blood type O. And that's really good news for me, as I have blood type O. But it turns out that the risk is not that substantial. It's not like a fivefold higher risk, but it is a double-digit increase in risk. Blood type AB, which is the rarest of the blood types, that's just 4% of the population, they have a 23% increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Blood type B, that is less common, but actually more common than AB, that's 12% of the population, they have 11% increased risk. Blood type A, that's 36% of the population, and they have a 5% increased risk over type O's, which comprise roughly half the population. That's the most common blood type, and they turn out to have less risk. This is based on an analysis of 62,000 nurses in the Nurses Health Study and 27,000 adults in the Health Professional Follow-Up Study, predominantly white, age 30 to 75, followed for at least 20 years. In non-O individuals, it turns out that there are higher levels of a clotting factor, something called factor 8 or von Willebrand factor. These complexes are 25% higher than group O individuals. So their blood is, in effect, thicker. It clots more easily. Other studies show that non-O individuals have higher lipid levels, higher levels of cholesterol, triglycerides, and inflammatory markers. And then it gets complicated because they start talking about intercellular adhesion molecules and soluble E-selectin levels, P-selectin, tumor necrosis factor, a lot of markers for cardiovascular risk and inflammation. So that would seem like prima facie evidence that blood type matters. And it does. I mean, there are differences overall in blood types. And what's of interest is that the diet that Dr. Didamo recommends for type O individuals is often very successful because it is a diet that suggests that you lower your carbohydrate intake, that you eat less grain starch. That's good for the high percentage of individuals who are insulin resistant, and that you avoid wheat and dairy. And that's going to make a lot of people feel better because of the high likelihood of wheat and dairy intolerance. So right there, half the population are type O's. You're going to put them on a healthy, wheat-free, low-carb, dairy-free diet. And a lot of people are going to rave over it. They're going to say that they feel a lot better. In fact, that's precisely the type of diet that I follow. Per the recommendations of Dr. Didamo, but my own trial and error, my own research, keying my metabolism to my food intake. This is the diet that seems to work best for me. Now, there is another article that came out this summer in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and it's by some Belgian researchers. And what they're saying here is that there is a whole lot of interest in the ABO blood group system and the role that it may play in determining an individual's susceptibility to certain diseases. They say, of the many authors of blood type diets, Dr. Didamo is arguably the most prolific. Within his initial ABO blood type diet book entitled Eat Right for Your Type, which was published in 1996, Didamo claims that each ABO blood type processes food differently, and adherence to a diet specific to an individual's ABO blood group could improve health, well-being, and energy levels, and reduce the risk of developing diseases such as cancer and cardiovascular disease. Didamo diets, one for each ABO blood type, are based on a theory that each blood type contains the genetic message of the diets and behaviors of our ancestors, and that these traits still have an impact on us today. The validity of the scientific basis for any of the blood type diets is beyond the scope of this systematic review. So what they're saying here is, look, they're not going to comment on the theory. They're just looking at the outcomes where they relate the likelihood of various diseases to blood type diets. Okay, so they're saying whatever the theory is, it's complicated. We're just going to look at what's the evidence. What's the evidence for the efficacy of blood type diets? So they looked at a bunch of articles, and what they found is that the vast majority of articles were not to their liking in terms of scientific rigor. So one, you know, one criticism of this is that they may have excluded articles that they thought were unscientific, but Dr. Didamo, and I haven't asked him about this, he might counter, oh, you know, they're cherry picking. We have studies, our own studies show that the diets are efficacious. But what they found was, unfortunately, that 16 articles were identified from a total of 1,415 references to the blood type diet. There was only one article that they felt was scientifically rigorous enough to meet the criteria for a systematic review. The identified article studied the variation between LDL cholesterol responses of different blood types to a low-fat diet. But the study didn't answer the current question. I think that that's the that may be the cholesterol article I'm referring to. No studies showed the health effects of ABO blood types were identified. So what they're saying is that no evidence currently exists to validate the purported health benefits of blood type diets. On the other hand, there's no evidence that contradicts the theory, but they couldn't find any rigorous study. Because in other words, you can create all the theories you want, and you can say that, you know, our blood type O is the oldest blood type, it's the primitive hunter-gatherer blood type, and then the others are more recent, and they more reflect what farmers ate, and blood type B, you know, I'm not sure if I'm getting this right, that this reflects the period of domestication of animals where they began to use dairy, and those people it's more suitable to drink milk. And all those things, you know, fine, you can say those, although that has been contested by such people as Dr. Lauren Cordain, who studied the history of blood types and doesn't believe that this holds any water. But what they say here in this article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition is that there is no evidence that the blood type diet, following the blood type diet, can make a difference in terms of health. They admit that evidence exists that links an increased vulnerability of certain blood types to particular diseases. So that may be valid, as in the study that shows greater heart disease incidence in non-O blood types. But that doesn't necessarily mean that following a certain diet is going to be beneficial for one or another or any of the many health conditions that Dr. Didamo claims in his book are helped by a specific blood type diet. There's also a controversial theory of what are called dietary lectins, and dietary lectins interact with blood types differently, but there's not, and that's fine, there's no question that that may be demonstrated in a test tube, but still there's not a lot of evidence that this lectin blood type interaction is going to turn around or prevent any type of health problem. So, you know, one would have to say that the blood type diet is an example of something that is very persuasive, gives people coherence, gives people a strategy for managing their diets, is very appealing, but something that lacks rigorous scientific evidence. And Dr. Didamo himself, who, by the way, I have enormous respect for because he's a brilliant guy, and he is very, very conversant with the scientific literature. He is a true genius kind of guy, and he has research underway. He's doing observational studies with some of the people who are following the blood type diet and promises to provide evidence that this strategy is going to be helpful for people following one or another diet type according to blood type. But as of the time of the publication of the article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, July 2013, there is a lack of scientific evidence that the blood type diet is really going to give us the lowdown on what type of food we should be eating. Now, this is not to say, I'm going to add this, there is an emerging science of something called nutrigenomics. And nutrigenomics is based on genetic factors that may determine the ideal diet. It may be that we evolved, humans evolved in different parts of the world. Some of our ancestors may have come from Nordic climes where they subsisted mostly on meat and fish. They didn't, you know, like in parts of northern Canada and Siberia, and especially during the Ice Age, there weren't a lot of plants to consume, but humans could hunt animals. And the descendants of people from that part of the world might do better on a animal protein and fat-based diet, whereas people who underwent civilization at a much earlier date, perhaps people from the Middle East originally, or from parts of Africa or parts of Asia, where domestication of grains and cereals and use of dairy products began early, these people might be better adapted to those types of foods. However, it's very hard to find a pure racial type anymore in the world. We are all, even though we may appear externally very distinct, some people with very light skin and red hair, other people with very dark skin, the vast majority of us are sort of mutts. We're genetically very mixed, and we may contain elements of populations from diverse parts of the world. So we can do various types of testing. We can do blood type testing, but that's a little crude. We can actually do more sophisticated testing with what are called HLA types. And HLA types do provide us with insights, and there are also genetic SNPs, which are little genetic coding fragments of our DNA that can be analyzed that can tell us if we're prone to various types of disease. But biology isn't necessarily destiny. And some of these SNPs or HLA types can tell us that we're predisposed to, say, for example, celiac disease and grain intolerance, or whether we're prone to criminality or schizophrenia or heart disease or cancer. But they don't tell us with absolute certainty that we're going to get these diseases, or even that there is a correct preventive strategy to undertake. So this is, you know, it's like BRCA 1 and 2 testing for women with breast cancer, or APOE 4 testing for people in terms of forecasting Alzheimer's. It does suggest a higher risk, but it's not so deterministic just to suggest that the diseases are going to be inevitable. And plus, it doesn't necessarily point out that there is a fail-safe nutritional strategy for people with these genes to follow. So there's a lot more research and a lot more conclusions that need to be drawn before we can wrap it up in a tidy package and present people with an easy-to-follow nutritional regimen based upon something as simple as and accessible as a blood type, which you can get these days with just a drop of blood on a piece of paper and, you know, have it analyzed quickly and inexpensively, and that lays out your entire genetic fate and your diet do's and don'ts. It's not yet ready for prime time, even with the most sophisticated research. This is an emerging field, and we may learn more and more, and there may be much more sophisticated tests to come that can tell us whether we're of one metabolic type or another, and what we should be doing to avoid diseases, and if there are any particular foods that are good for us, bad for us, it remains to be seen. But the verdict so far on the eat right for your type diet is that currently it lacks rigorous scientific evidence. This, at least according to researchers who published in the July 2013 edition of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Next, our clinical focus on today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast is on licorice for gastrointestinal disease. This month, I'm going to do a scientific presentation at the Heal Thy Practice conference in Long Beach, California, and I was asked to select three different nutraceuticals that had a beneficial effect on the GI tract. So, of course, I chose probiotics, and I also chose peppermint. And in a previous Intelligent Medicine podcast, I talked about the gastrointestinal benefits of peppermint. So today I'm going to talk about the third one that I selected, which is licorice. Licorice is a demulcent, and a demulcent herb has the effect of acting as a protective barrier on irritated or inflamed tissue. So that's what licorice does in the gastrointestinal tract. There are many disorders of the gastrointestinal tract that involve inflammation. And we can start with the mouth. People frequently develop painful mouth sores or sometimes tongue burning, inflammation of the oral mucosa. And actually swishing with a ginger tincture, or in particular a concentrated solution of licorice. Did I say ginger? I think it meant licorice. Swishing with a licorice solution can be a very effective way of dealing with mouth inflammation. The type of licorice that I like to use for that is something called glycyrrhizin. That's a really super concentrated form of licorice with great anti-inflammatory effects, but unfortunately with a lot of side effects, as we'll see later. So we'll start with the mouth. Then, of course, you get the esophagus, and people suffer from GERD and reflux. And then you can go in the stomach, and in the stomach people have gastritis and ulcers. And if you go a little further down, you're in the intestine, and people suffer from Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And so on it goes. Licorice can have beneficial effects throughout the gastrointestinal tract. And many traditional herbal remedies take advantage of licorice, either singly or in combination. Lots of traditional Chinese remedies are used in combination with licorice. Now, licorice has many other effects on the body. We're going to concentrate on gastrointestinal effects, but licorice actually can be used as sort of a steroid-like medication. It has anti-inflammatory effects, so it can be used in conditions like asthma. It can be used for patients who have adrenal fatigue and low blood pressure, because it will raise blood pressure. That's good for some people, but it's bad for others. And it is useful in a wide variety of conditions. But let's take a look at what it does in gastrointestinal diseases. It has steroid-like anti-inflammatory activity. So actually, at one point, I developed a product. This is way back, 20 or more years ago, for a vitamin company, which was a topical licorice extract which could be used for skin inflammation. And it really, there are various types of licorice salves that you can use for eczema or inflamed skin. It's very, very helpful. It's kind of, for what dermatologists use. I mean, half the time when you go to a dermatologist, you got a skin problem, they'll give you steroids. Well, why not use a steroid-like herb, which is licorice? That makes a lot of sense for many skin conditions. Also, licorice has antioxidant effects. It has antiviral effects. And lest we forget, the liver is part of the gastrointestinal system. If you have liver disease, you go see a gastroenterologist who is sometimes a subspecialist in hepatology or liver disease. And it turns out that licorice has antiviral effects, particularly the glycyrrhizin portion of licorice, which, as I said before, can have harmful side effects. But when used in liver disease, when it's used in a safe way to prevent the side effects, you can get antiviral effects. In fact, the Japanese have concentrated a licorice extract called glycyrrhizin, which is given intravenously. And I sometimes give this intravenously to my patients with chronic hepatitis because it's soothing and anti-inflammatory to the liver, but it also has specific antiviral properties. It's been shown to inhibit the replication of the hepatitis virus. So this is a really cool property of licorice. that we'll talk in just a moment about the side effects of glycyrrhizin. Also, licorice causes enhanced mucus production, which is mucus is a protective layer that sits on top of the lining of your esophagus, your stomach, your intestinal tract, your mouth. And so that is a desirable quality of demulcent herbs. They actually kind of create sort of a lubricating surface on your mucosa. And licorice also supports wound healing, which is an interesting feature of licorice because many gastrointestinal remedies, they block the acid, for example, powerful acid-blocking drugs like Nexium, but they don't promote healing. And licorice has a specific effect in promoting healing. So it does something quite different in healing gastrointestinal problems than many of the current drugs that we use. So the GI diseases that are helped by licorice, as I mentioned earlier, aphthous ulcers or, you know, mouth blisters, gastroesophageal reflux, ulcers and gastritis, infectious hepatitis, and then I put a question mark by ulcerative colitis. I don't use it much in ulcerative colitis because I'm not sure that it works that far down in the GI tract. All right, so here's the problem with glycyrrhizin. Well, it's a very potent steroid-like molecule, and it also has antiviral effects. It may promote sodium retention. And if you hold on to sodium, your blood pressure goes up and you retain water. And sometimes you can literally have weight gain from water retention. I remember a patient that I told, actually many years ago this happened, and the name of this patient resonates for me because her name was Hoffman. So I treated a fellow Hoffman who had adrenal insufficiency. She was really weak and tired. I said, drink a couple of cups of licorice tea every day. And she did so. And then she called me back and she said, I think I'm gaining weight. And I said, well, did you get on the scale? And, you know, objectively, what is it? And she said, it's something like 8 or 10 pounds. And my initial thought was, you know, patients say the funniest things. That can't really be. Because, I don't know, maybe she's exaggerating or scale's wrong. So I said, come into the office and we'll check you out. And we got on the scale, and sure enough, her face looked a little bloated, and she had gained fully 8 or 10 pounds from her previous weight, which we recorded when she first came to the office prior to taking the licorice. And so I realized that she was someone who is genetically very susceptible to what is called a pseudoaldosterone effect of licorice, which means that it has the effect of causing sodium retention and potassium depletion. And indeed, when I did a blood test on her, potassium was pretty low. Some people are more affected by this than others. You have to be careful even with drinking licorice tea. And if you have high blood pressure, licorice that is not deglycyrrhizinated, we'll get to that in just a moment, could be a problem for you. Also, potassium loss could be very dangerous, especially for people who have cardiac arrhythmias. One very specific danger of potassium deficiency is in patients who are on the heart drug Digoxin, because you can get very dangerous cardiac arrhythmias on that drug. So if you're on Digoxin, you probably should stay away from licorice, although the deglycyrrhizinated kind is probably going to be safe for you. We'll get to that shortly. Also, this is something I didn't realize until a few years into my career. I didn't realize that the research had been done. Maybe it had only been done in the past few years, but the glycyrrhizin part of licorice actually can deplete testosterone. That's usually not such a big deal for women, and in fact a desirable effect, because women who have excess body hair or acne can take advantage of this property of licorice. But for men, this might not be so good because it could depress libido in a man who is already maybe borderline in testosterone production. So that's something to look out for if you're giving people whole licorice or licorice containing glycyrrhizin. Also, glycyrrhizin can cause cortisol to increase, and that's good for some people. Some people who have very low adrenal function, we take advantage of that. We give them full licorice, which is glycyrrhizin, which has glycyrrhizin, and we can actually help them get their blood pressure up. People with too low blood pressure feel weak and woozy and fatigued, and sometimes we want to enhance cortisol. So licorice is a part of many adrenal support formulas. But it's not so good for people who already have high levels of cortisol. And very high levels of cortisol can cause you to maintain excessive body fat. And that gets in the way of weight loss. So in terms of other options, we have something called DGL, which you probably have heard about, deglycerinated licorice. That's a tough word to pronounce. Deglycerinated licorice. Well, deglycerinated licorice has most of the glycyrrhizin removed from it. Remember, glycyrrhizin is pretty cool stuff because it's anti-inflammatory and may be helpful for ulcers. It may be helpful for esophagitis. But it turns out that if you use DGL, you get a lot of the anti-inflammatory effects without the harmful side effects of glycyrrhizin, which can raise your blood pressure, lower your potassium, lower your testosterone, cause your cortisol to go up. And the way you take it is you take quite a lot of these babies. DGL tablets dissolve in the mouth. You should suck on them slowly and take them in between meals. And you can take virtually unlimited amount of these. You can go 6, 10, 12, 15 a day, you know, much as you would chew gum in between meals or chew on a lifesaver, except that DGL has a very soothing effect on the mouth, the esophagus, and the stomach, and can really promote healing. You can take it with or without ulcer medication. If you have a severe ulcer, you know, you may temporarily have to take an acid blocker. But the DGL will work in a complementary way to promote healing and coat the gastrointestinal lining while the repair is underway, and is a very useful way to deal with all kinds of gastrointestinal maladies. In a study performed in 1982 in the journal Gut, I love the name of these journals, Gut, DGL, 6 tablets per day were given for 6 weeks and were found to be equivalent to the ulcer drug Tagamet for relieving ulcer pain and promoting healing. So there you have it in a toe-to-toe comparison of a natural nutraceutical to a popular ulcer drug. They were virtually equivalent in the results. So many of my patients have healed using DGL and aloe vera juice and marshmallow tea. These are some of the things that are helpful in soothing esophagitis or ulcers. Of course, it all depends on the type of diet you're on. Diet is a very important element in healing gastrointestinal ailments. And so many people want to eat their cake and have it. They want to eat all kinds of corrosive, irritating, fermentive foods and still heal their ulcers. And therefore, they take powerful acid-blocking drugs, causing all kinds of horrendous side effects. And unfortunately, that's our main way of dealing with gastrointestinal problems. So I find licorice very, very valuable in our arsenal against GI problems. And if you're suffering from occasional heartburn, check out DGL. The one on our website is made by RX Vitamins, chewable licorice, available at drhoffman.com. So that's all the time we have for today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Remember, Intelligent Medicine Podcasts come to you free, and I really enjoy doing them. But one of the ways that you can make sure that you get a steady stream of information from us is by supporting us. Don't send us money in plain brown envelopes. You can just patronize drhoffman.com, get some of our supplements. Our prices are fair and equitable. And we have a price match guarantee, so they are high-quality supplements, and they may be a little more pricey than generic brands, but the quality makes a difference. These are products that I select personally for our patients and make available to the general public at drhoffman.com. And our price match guarantee means that if you can find the same product elsewhere for cheaper, we will match the price and make sure that you get the best quality supplements possible. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us, and make sure you join us for our next edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.